You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey, folks. It's Ben Mathis here with just a quick favor to ask. We love having great advertisers support the show, but in order to continue doing that, we need your help. So please go to podsurvey.com/kick and take a quick anonymous survey that'll help us get to know you a little better. That way we can show advertisers just how enthusiastic our audience is about Kick-Ass News and keep the show free for listeners like you. Even if you've taken our podcast listener survey before, the current one is new and different, and it's really important that we have lots of listener feedback, so I'd really appreciate it if you take a minute to fill out this new one. Plus, as a thank you, once you've completed the survey, you can enter to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's podsurvey.com/kick, podsurvey.com/kick. Thanks for your help, and thanks for listening. Today's podcast is sponsored by Nadex. Do you want to try day trading the markets but worried about the risk? What if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front? Well, you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See for yourself why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. More than 40 years after the war in Vietnam ended with 58,000 American lives lost, this tragic and transformative chapter in American history still haunts our national conscience and leaves many scars that remain on both sides. Even today, we're still arguing about what went wrong, who was to blame, and whether it was all worth it. Now, the master storytellers behind the award-winning PBS documentaries on the Civil War and the Second World War present an immersive 360-degree narrative of what happened in Vietnam that might just offer a little more clarity, and perhaps for some who experienced it, a bit of closure. The Vietnam War is a 10-part, 18-hour documentary that tells the epic story of the Vietnam War as it's never before been told on film, featuring testimony from nearly 80 witnesses, including many Americans who fought in the war and others who opposed it, as well as Vietnamese combatants and civilians from both the winning and the losing sides. It's produced and directed by Emmy and Peabody Award-winning filmmakers Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. For nearly 30 years, they've collaborated on multi-part documentary films about American history and culture that have been some of the highest-rated programs in the history of public television, including their epic documentary series The Civil War, Jazz, The War about World War II, Baseball, and Prohibition. Today, they join me on the podcast to talk about why the discussion of the Vietnam War continues to evolve 40 years later, the ways their own perceptions have changed since they were young people growing up in the turbulent 60s, and how hindsight has given birth to some humbling and surprising epiphanies among those who fought on both sides. They discuss why it was so important for them to present all perspectives on the Vietnam War, not just the American viewpoint, and how the stories of many of the American and Vietnamese soldiers sound remarkably similar. They share some of the revelations that came out of the Nixon and LBJ tapes, how Nixon may have committed treason by back-channeling negotiations with the Vietnamese while Johnson was still president. Sound familiar? And how in some ways the lessons of Vietnam have changed America for the better. They also talk about the daunting task of sifting through the treasure trove of archival material on the war, how they convinced veterans of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army to talk about the war on camera, and what Vietnamese audiences have had to say about the film. Plus, the man behind the acclaimed miniseries that re-examined the American Civil War weighs in on the Confederate statue controversy. Coming up with documentary filmmakers Lynn Novick and Ken Burns in just a moment. For 30 years, the acclaimed filmmakers Ken Burns and Lynn Novick have collaborated on award-winning documentaries about such diverse subjects in American history and culture as the Civil War, the Dust Bowl, jazz, and baseball. Now they have a new 10-part documentary film, The Vietnam War, which airs on PBS starting Sunday, September 17th. Lynn and Ken, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed this film. I also enjoyed your film about World War II. And apparently, as I understand it, the World War II project that you guys made 10 years ago sort of led you into this film about Vietnam, right?
Indeed. I think that war is an extraordinarily revealing subject at any point in American history. But having grappled with the Civil War, our most important event in American history, and the Second World War, arguably the most important event, certainly the biggest cataclysm in human history, it became really obvious as that project was winding down that something we had talked about now needed to be fully engaged. And that was dealing with what Lynn and I both think is the most important event in American history after the Second World War, the Vietnam, this little understood, unfinished business for us Americans that nevertheless colors and mostly negatively our present moment. And we felt that if we could unpack what had taken place in Vietnam and show a variety of perspectives, not just solely American perspectives, of which there are many, 50, but also Vietnamese perspectives on the winning and the losing side, the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese, soldiers and civilians alike, we could have a clearer view of it and perhaps sort of exit the hardened silos that have made a kind of civil conversation about the Vietnam impossible, and also polluted our own conversations today about our own contemporary situation, whether it's about foreign policy, whether it's about politics, whether it's about race, whether it's about culture. A lot of that disunion and hyperpartisanship is part of the legacy of Vietnam, which we hope to, in some way, with telling this complicated story, help people begin to have conversations about what actually took place, not the kind of conventional, superficial, conventional wisdom that's now been almost entirely discredited by recent scholarship.
Yeah, and I want to ask about your perspective during those events. Now, you both are old enough to remember at least some part of Vietnam. Ken, you might have even made draft age before it was all over. Growing up, what were your ideas about the war when it was happening?
You know, I wish I could tell you with any sense of authority. I do remember at the beginning of this project, I felt kind of arrogantly confident that this was finally a subject that I knew something about. I'd lived through it. I'd come of age as a person. I followed the Vietnam War from 64 on, reading the daily paper, watching the nightly news, and watching. I lived on a college campus, so watching the upheavals that took place there. But beginning this project was a kind of instantaneous humiliation of what I didn't know. It was sort of, somebody, I thought I knew how to swim, but apparently I was in the shallow end, and beginning this project was being dumped into the deep end, and the trauma of that, the humiliation of that, which I hope, transformed itself into a kind of daily humility. Both of us meant that we would be confronting things that were just coming out that changed our worldview. So the shorthand is, I lost my baggage a long time ago and I've never found it.
I was born in 1962, so essentially the Vietnam War overshadowed my entire childhood. and coming of age, and it was just always there, sort of seeming perpetual war. And there was a sense that it was just never going to end, and that many people were, as I became old enough to understand the world a little bit, that was coinciding with the time in which the American public was growing increasingly disillusioned and losing patience with the war in the early 70s. And so I knew it was catastrophic. I knew that people were very, very upset, and that many people were trying to get out of it, you know, in terms of didn't want their sons to go there by the time I was aware. And I understood pretty early on that, you know, our leaders had not told the truth about this. But beyond that, I was sort of at a loss to understand, how did we get there? What happened? You know, what brought us into this horrendous situation? And then, you know, like a lot of people, my understanding, at least as a teenager, was shaped by the very affecting Hollywood movies that started to come out pretty soon after the war ended, in the late 70s, early 80s. And for a lot of people, those, you know, Apocalypse Now, Platoon, Full Metal Jacket, these films sort of have become what many people think is what happened in Vietnam. And we had to very forcefully say to ourselves, those movies are fiction. They're extremely resonant, and they have shaped a whole generation's understanding of the war, but they do not represent reality. They're great works of art in some cases. But our film is really an attempt to go back to the beginning and figure out what happened from every perspective, Vietnamese and American, people who fought in the war, people who fought against the war, people who lives were upended by it, who didn't know what to do, families that were divided, and Vietnamese who fought to win the war, and those who lost the war and their country. And sort of an epic journey of 10 years to go back and figure out what was this thing that was happening while I was growing up.
Yeah, and in talking about the movies that came out almost in the moment, like Apocalypse Now, it makes me wonder, do you think that you'd be making a very different film if you had tried to tell this story 30 or even 20 years ago?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you just think about what would happen if we'd done it 10 years after the fall of Saigon in 85, America in a recession, people talking about Japan being ascendant, that we were on the wrong side of the Pacific Rim. It would be clear that Vietnam would be this ball and chain, this first loss, the symbol of an inevitable American decline. If we waited 20 years to 95 in the middle of the biggest peacetime economic expansion up to that point in American history, the sole superpower, Japan in decline, having won the first Gulf War, Vietnam would be important, but it wouldn't be this albatross, this shadow hanging over us. If you'd waited till 2005, 30 years after, we'd be sort of stuck in Afghanistan and Iraq. We'd be after 9/11, and new anxiety had replaced the old Cold War anxiety about global terrorism. Who knows? But what happens is that after a while, you can liberate yourself from whatever mountaintop you might have looked at, and not average those, but find a new position that's based on scholarship and it's based on the observations of people, and be free of whatever prison the present moment might put you in with regard to how you look at Vietnam. And I think we've always felt, regardless of the subjects we are doing, that we had to, in order to do legitimate history, get 25 or 30, or in this case, 40 years out from the end of the event, so that we could really offer new perspectives and permit all the different voices that both Lynn and I have been talking about to help us fix more precisely, to triangulate our relationship to those very complicated facts. And I think most important, to permit complication to be there. Sometimes there's no easy answer, that this film is raising questions. And we are always in our media culture, in our binary computer world, looking for a very simple, definitive, black and white, yes or no, good or bad answer. And you're not going to get it out of Vietnam. And that's to its credit. And the things that it stirs up within one mirror the things that the problems that are being stirred up in the people that we've interviewed. And so we just wish to have people watch it and begin to talk about it and have conversations that are civil and not informed by some sort of toxic misunderstandings or arguments that are beside the point.
One of the things that would have been really impossible, except for really the last 10, 15 years, was to have the access that we had in Vietnam. Because, you know, we normalized relations with Vietnam in the 90s, and it really started to open up relations between our countries and veterans going back and Vietnamese veterans on the winning side being, you know, able to connect with Americans. It's a different mindset there about what happened. They're curious about our experiences of the war because of this opening. and our relationships have sort of entered a different phase, and that really contributed to making it possible for us to spend quite a lot of time there and to have a kind of access that no other filmmakers have had, really, to ordinary Vietnamese people who survived this war there, and hear their thoughts and their experiences, their memories, which are as complicated and painful and sometimes conflicted as many of the American witnesses, because the Vietnamese people really haven't had a chance to openly reckon with the losses that they suffered. You know, they lost 1 million soldiers on the winning side. They lost 3 million civilians out of a country of 30 million. And they're asking questions now because their society is in a different place. It's a closed society with an open internet. And so there is a sense of, you know, what happened and why, and how do we make sense of it? How do we find meaning in it? And we were the beneficiaries of that sort of spirit bubbling up and getting the chance to speak to ordinary people there and bring their testimony back, which really made our film different than anything that has ever been done in this way about the Vietnam War in any documentary that we know of.
Yeah, this film really stands out in that it gives a much more complete picture of the war than I've ever seen, giving equal time or almost equal time to the Viet Cong, as well as the Arvin soldiers, civil servants, civilians in Vietnam. I found that refreshing because it seems like the discussion here in the U.S. usually centers on how it relates to our own history and how it affected American lives. One could argue that that's just always how it is with these things, but do you think that America has a particular degree of narcissism when it comes to the Vietnam War?
Well, I think that in some ways we do, but I also think that we have embedded in us, and certainly the divisions in the country reflect so many different kinds of things. It's hard to say that Americans are one thing or another, a deep curiosity about what actually takes place. And some people have not been reticent. Some people have not just retreated to argument. Oh, well, you know, if we'd replaced this general with that general sooner, we would have won the war, which is in many ways like saying, well, you know, if we took our pitcher out in the sixth inning instead of the seventh, when he fell apart, we would have won the game. And you go, well, maybe, but it's not what happened. You didn't win the game. And so I think that rather than retreat to these kind of defensive, behind these defensive ramparts, we have an opportunity with the triangulation, as I said, that comes through with these different voices to perhaps soften our own hard positions and begin to embrace a more complicated view of the past that helps us negotiate the very complicated present that we find ourselves in. So polarized, mass demonstrations, asymmetrical warfare, stolen classified material, accusations that a political campaign reached out during a national election to affect that election to a foreign country. All of these things that we just, you know, are seemingly echoes and are echoes of Vietnam, but not repetition. It might just give us some perspective and some distance to understand our present moment.
Now, when you reached out to find interviews with the Viet Cong and others in Vietnam, how did you go about tracking down some of these people? How did you even know where to begin?
Well, it's certainly fair to say that we had quite a lot of help because we don't speak Vietnamese. And so we had to, and we were very lucky to enlist the services of a wonderful man in Vietnam named Ho Dang Hoa, who's a veteran himself, grew up in Hanoi, and has very sort of good credentials and connections in the communities there that we wanted to reach out to. And we basically charged him with helping us find people who, for example, had survived particular battles, where we had an American who had been on a hill 875 in Dak Tho in the fall of 1967 with a brutal battle where we had to take a hill and, as happened so many times in Vietnam, you know, abandon the hill afterwards. And in this particular case, it was covered in the news extensively in the U.S. because it was a prolonged battle. And it turns out when we found a North Vietnamese soldier who had been there, and there are very few surviving to this day, I think he and another guy are the only ones in that regiment who are alive at this moment. He explained that they got there a month ahead of time because they figured that the Americans would want to control the high ground. So they prepared the battlefield and dug in there and waited for us. And that's a remarkable way that we can triangulate this experience between him and the American soldier about what happened on the ground in a very particular moment. So Hoa, that's just one example of the maybe 100 people that he introduced us to in Vietnam, who we interviewed about 35, and 29 are in the film. And, you know, he was able to sort of explain to them that we wanted to hear the human story of the war. What was it really like for you? And they said almost universally, you know, we never really speak about the war that way. We don't speak about the war that much, period. And we want our children and our grandchildren to know the price we paid, what it was really like. The man I was speaking about was actually underneath on the hill when he was hit by napalm. And he described what that was like, to be basically caught on fire like a torch. And he wanted the world to know what that was like. And that sort of was repeated over and over again. And they were also very interested in, you know, hearing from us in the process of getting to know them. You know, what have you heard from the Americans? What were their experiences like? And they had, you know, things like they liked American tea rations because they didn't always have enough food. And they envied certain aspects of the American equipment, and the Americans wished they could have had AK-47s, which worked a lot better. So we found this kind of commonality of the soldiers, you know, after all these years, having a conversation with each other in the film.
Yeah, I was wondering, were there moments in your interviews with either the Americans or the Vietnamese where they were surprised to learn something about what was going on with the quote-unquote enemy, the other side?
Well, that is a product of putting the film together. I think what surprised us initially mm-hmm. was the way in which the Americans or the Vietnamese, it doesn't really matter, opened up and so generously shared with us their experiences. And then as you begin to process their commentary and intertwine it with others, you begin to see not just the similarities, but the ways in which they sort of fit into a much larger pattern that complicates in a good way the Vietnam War. Then when you're finished with the film and you begin to share it, you begin to get feedback. The American soldiers saying, wow, the thing I like best is understanding that the guy that haunts my dreams, who is forever young trying to kill me, is an old grandpa like me and saying the same thing as me. I never knew my enemy, and that was one of the big mistakes in Vietnam. And conversely, the North Vietnamese soldier is saying, hey, you know, looking at the film, I realized at that time I always saw the demonstrations against the war as a sign of American weakness, which our state exploited, that we were, you know, a weak nation. I now see the demonstrations as the strength of America, the ability for people to express mm-hmm. their own views, something he did not have the luxury to do. And so you begin to see that as we collect this material, it's revelatory to us and perhaps them as they express something. And then again, as we put it together, there's something revelatory about similarities and differences. And then when we share it, we begin to expand the conversation and transcend a lot of the kind of obvious differences and begin, we hope, a process of healing and reconciliation and understanding.
Yeah, and one of the most interesting aspects of that for me was, you know, as you said, the Viet Cong and the American soldiers start to sound a lot alike when they talk about the war in this film.
Yeah.
And one of the most surprising elements for me was just how many of the American soldiers actually compared the Viet Cong to our own founding fathers in the American Revolution.
Yeah, that's right. It stunned us, you know, that there's a period over two or three episodes in which there are five or six analogies to our American Revolution. And really, you know, we hadn't sort of consciously said, oh, let's connect the dots. But as our film was forming, as its structure was taking shape, these things just stood out and jumped out. And what follows then, too, is just heartfelt admiration on the part of historical figures, officers speaking after a battle about their respect for the enemy, on camera interviews about how much we wish we'd fought on their side with them. I would have been happy to fight with them. A kind of just amazing sense of how well disciplined not only the North Vietnamese regulars were, but the Viet Cong guerrillas were, how well trained, how incredibly prepared they were to fight a fight that in retrospect, the Americans, expecting a kind of conventional warfare as in Korea or particularly World War II, were not finding and were not prepared. And a good deal of what went wrong issued out of that.
We're going to take a quick break now, and then I'll be back with more with documentary filmmakers Ken Burns and Lynn Novick when we come back in just a moment. Warning, if you're drowning in debt you can't afford, do not let the credit card companies trick you into thinking you have to pay it all back, because you don't. What the credit card companies don't want you to know is that there's actually a way to get debt-free without paying off your entire debt or going bankrupt. If you have $5,000 or more in credit card debt, you now have the right to let Credit Associates settle that debt for a fraction of what you owe. For free information, call 1-800-500-0351. They'll even show you how much money you could save. If you can't afford to pay off all your debt, don't let the credit card companies trick you into thinking you have to. Call Credit Associates now for free information on how to get debt-free faster than you thought possible without debt consolidation or bankruptcy. Credit Associates depends on your success and offers a guarantee, so there's no risk. For free information, call 1-800-500-0351. That's 1-800-500-0351. And now, back to the podcast. Were there other myths and misconceptions that unraveled for you during the course of making this film?
We really, as Ken said earlier, we really had to just check our baggage at the door and start back at the beginning. But a number of things do sort of stick with us. And one of them is that in going back through the incredible presidential audio recordings where you hear our presidents, especially Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, speaking privately about the war and what they're trying to do and whether they can accomplish their goals. And it's an ongoing discussion. And of course, it's the most important thing, one of the most important things they're dealing with in their presidencies. You hear a tremendous amount of doubt, worry, concern that it's not going to go well, that there's no way out, that we can't seem to solve this sort of insolvable problem where we have a South Vietnamese government we're trying to help that is not popular and, in fact, is sometimes alienating the people that we're trying to protect, that the North Vietnamese, as Ken was saying, are incredibly determined, that our air power doesn't seem to make a difference no matter how much we bomb, more supplies just keep coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So all the ways in which we think we would be able to win the war, there's no way, there's no formula that they can see ever that is sort of a path to victory. And yet they go out in public and speak about the war as if it's going well. And, you know, it helped us see them as not villains or sort of evil people, but frail human beings with flaws and frailties and egos. And, you know, they're imperfect and they're trying to make decisions with the information they have. And sometimes they feel trapped. So these recordings gave us a much more human dimension of the larger-than-life figures that we've never really known intimately in that way. And that was revelatory among many, many, many revelations Kosbajic provided.
Yeah, and it does highlight, I guess, the disingenuousness of politicians when you're hearing, you know, guys like LBJ in private speaking about their anguish and how tormented and reluctant they are about the war. And then, like you said, the very next day they go out and speak in such absolute terms about the certainty of victory.
Yeah,
Sounding foolish, I'd like to suggest that politicians are super easy targets.
Yeah, of course.
This is a human condition that we can have within us complex psychological dynamics that express and understand and see doubt, but often our outer actions are sometimes diametrically opposed to that, as well as our words. It's only politicians who get caught in the act of this, and particularly these two politicians, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, with the voluminous thousands of hours of tapes that exist and have not yet been entirely transcribed, that provide us with this intimate view. But I think it speaks to a larger issue, which is when you're doing wars, it's easy to just stay on the outer wars, that is to say, between armies. Mm-hmm. But what often happens, what always happens, is that there are complex internal psychological and emotional negotiations and wars and struggles taking place within people. And several dozen of the 79 people you meet visibly express to us and show through their actions a kind of transformation that they go through in the course of this war, which is in itself a mini individual war. And in some ways, in a Shakespearean sense, that's really as interesting, if not more interesting, than the who won, who lost in the larger military sense of the word. And we're stunned and so incredibly grateful for the willingness of so many of the people that we interviewed to share with us those inner struggles.
Yeah, I think if anything, this film seems to speak to how hindsight shakes loose even the most stubbornly held beliefs. So many of the people in this film seem to have a humility and even a shame about their actions during the war, not just the soldiers, but even some of the protesters who vilified the soldiers here in the U.S. It strikes me as a particularly timely lesson about not blocking out other perspectives, not being so reactionary, and not clinging to dogma.
Yeah, we agree completely. And that was another revelation of fulfillment to see many people who protested the war being pretty tough on themselves in terms of some of their tactics, which at certain times became very sort of radical and violent and alienated people at the time when they were actually in the process of winning the public over. And also, you know, it's there, one of the myths of the war is that every soldier was spat on and called a baby killer, and that's absolutely not true. And a lot of the anti-war movement was focused on getting the soldiers home, and revering them, and there were soldiers who took part in the anti-war movement. So like everything else in the story, it is very complicated. But that being said, we have seen in our film and we've seen in the events as we've been going around the country, the sense that there is some guilt and self-reflection about the excesses of targeting the soldiers and blaming them for the policies that really they had nothing to do with. The people who made the mistakes and who need to be held accountable are the leaders, you know, the failures that they made at the policy level of deciding this was important and sending our troops there and putting them in difficult, sometimes impossible situations. And that's a lesson that we feel pretty clearly our country has learned from the Vietnam War, that we don't blame the soldiers anymore.
Yeah, that was kind of the turning point where we were able to begin to separate policy from the boots on the ground. Well, you know, and I don't want to be too Pollyanna-ish in trying to find the silver lining in such tragic events, but taking this long view of history, are there other ways that the war has perhaps had a positive impact in terms of strategy and policy from the top, or perhaps in terms of how we've collectively grown from this experience?
I think history places you in a position, perhaps at least at times, accept and interpret things through a fairly optimistic lens. And you could, as I was suggesting earlier, as our North Vietnamese soldiers suggested, that the protests that tore America apart also represented the ultimate expression of a democratic people. That you could, in the middle of a war, which had never, ever happened before, rise up, and it was the people's opposition to the war that, in essence, helped contribute to the end of it. That's a wholly positive thing. I also think that you have many instances in which the military heeded some things that were going on. I mean, some of the things we need to debate, whether an all-volunteer army is exactly the way to go, that takes a lot of political pressure off the military and particularly the policymakers. It permits you to have wars that go on and on and on because we have a separate military class that suffers its losses apart and alone from the rest of us. But they didn't like the collateral damage of killing civilians, and so they developed guided bombing, and they didn't like having their planes shot down, and they developed stealth technology, and they didn't like not being able to fly at night, and they learned how to do that. They didn't like the fact that, in another way, that the press had unlimited access to events and therefore revealed to the American people unmediated information. And so we now have this wonderful euphemism, being embedded, but that means being surrounded. I think the first Gulf War represents a Vietnam generation come of age into leadership, determined not to make the same mistakes, to have a set objective, a very clear definition of what winning means, to discipline oneself to achieve that objective and nothing more, do it with a lot of help to get the public behind you, all of those sorts of things the first Gulf War represents. However, you know, as we say in our film, you know, that lessons were learned but then forgotten again, and secrets were, you know, revealed but then locked away again. And I think that's a huge part of human nature, that whatever may issue out in a positive sense can also then, you know, be forgotten. And we've seen in the last 16, 17 years, policymakers, I think, almost not deliberately, but there's a kind of sense that they have not read any history and have not seen not have learned the lessons of Vietnam. And I think the lessons of Vietnam are fairly evident to anybody regardless of their persuasion.
You get into how, I guess, draft dodging was not a uniquely American sport during this war. The film talks about how the sons of the communist officials were sent abroad, or they would bribe a doctor to say that they were unfit to serve. As is so often the case, it seems that on both sides, the war was fought by the poor and undereducated.
And that was true in South Vietnam as well. There were what they called Saigon cowboys. There were a lot of men of draft age running around Saigon in various kinds of business and working for the Americans and, you know, taking advantage of the opportunities that the war provided economically. And the South Vietnamese, our allies, the people that were bearing the brunt of the fighting were the people from the countryside who both were supplying the soldiers to the army and also bearing the brunt of the shelling and the firepower and the bombing. And so there's this paradoxical problem that people were trying to help are actually suffering the most in a way, under the, you know, the hope to help them is not helping them as much as we would have liked.
One of the stories I've never heard was apparently Nixon tried to back channel negotiations while LBJ was still president. There's a conversation where LBJ calls what Nixon's done treason.
Yes.
And at the very least, I suppose it would be a violation of the Logan Act. Yet LBJ and Humphrey, who was running against Nixon at the time, chose not to publicly call him out on this. Why do you suppose that was?
Well, I think there are lots of divided and conflicted opinions. It's such an amazing moment that the Nixon campaign and Nixon himself reached out to the South Vietnamese as Humphrey's standing in the poll was rising and Johnson had announced the good news that there had been some progress in the negotiation. And this was a desperate stopgap attempt, you know, with echoes in the present to reach out to a foreign government, in this case, the South Vietnamese, and say, look, boycott the peace talks. You'll get better terms from the hardliner Nixon than you will from the soft liberal Humphrey. Even though both Nixon and his national security, his future national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, knew absolutely they had to get out of Vietnam. And Johnson was able to obtain the information that this contact had taken place and described to the Republican leader, his friend Everett Dirksen, that this was treason, and Dirksen agreed. And so it's one of the most dramatic moments. And then, as I said, echoes our current investigations and thoughts about stuff. And in fact, Nixon won by only 0.7 of a percentage point in that election. And you do have to wonder, it is just argumentative and Monday morning quarterbacking again, what would have happened if either Johnson or Humphrey had released that news. And there's lots of varying opinions about why that was. One, Johnson doesn't want to reveal the intelligence methods by which he gathered that information, that he was becoming more hard-lined as the year went on after he had resigned and would been sympathetic to what he thought might be Nixon's hard-line stance, that Humphrey didn't want to in any way look like it's sour grapes, that he wanted to win in his own right, thought he might win in his own right, and wasn't going to sort of say, see, and forever be told, well, if they hadn't brought this out, Nixon would have won and Humphrey wouldn't have. And so we just are not going to know until we further dive into this subject. And in point of fact, we are diving into the administration of LBJ, and I hope that we'll be able to triangulate, to beat that word to death, a new view of those events as new scholarship comes out, as it did during the course of our production, about this incredibly dramatic moment that, again, has echoes with today.
And another historic figure who plays an important role in this documentary is, of course, Robert McNamara. And as I watched the parts about McNamara, this guy who was known as this master of systems analysis, who went from president of Ford to secretary of defense, I got to be honest, it was hard not to think of a Rex Tillerson or even Trump himself. Did you want people to draw some sort of a cautionary tale against putting, you know, American lives and military decisions in the hand of a businessman?
We have to just clarify that we've been working on the film for 10 years, and we actually finished editing it essentially before anything happened in the election that was definitive, before the caucuses even happened. So we were not at all thinking about current political realities, but more, as Ken was saying, kind of the age-old existential questions of leadership and the responsibility to make the right decisions so that young men don't die for a cause that's not worth fighting for, which is what people eventually many people came to feel was the case with Vietnam. In the film, one of the veterans says, you know, 18-year-olds are great soldiers. They will do anything you ask of them. They don't need to be explained why. They will just do what they are asked of, and they will do it bravely, and they will do it, you know, honorably. And the responsibility is on the adults to make the decisions so that their lives are not wasted. And, you know, we were on the stage the other day with Secretary of State John Kerry and Senator John McCain, and they both spoke about their memories at this time. And one of the things they take away from it is this horrendous failures of leadership. And that's, you know, that's a cautionary tale or a lesson or a message for any leader, not just our current administration.
And both John Kerry and John McCain served as advisors or participated in some way in the film, but you didn't interview them, right? Why was that?
Well, no, I wouldn't call them advisors.
Okay.
One of the earliest meetings we took after we assembled a lot of our ducks was to go to them. Both men I've had a relationship with for many, many years, and say to them, we need your help. We're going to do this. We're trying to appeal. And I think it's an important footnote here that this represents an extraordinarily bipartisan effort. You know, we have funders from across the political spectrum. We engage the help of a corporation, Bank of America, willing to permit a deep dive into a controversial subject because they're interested in fostering, you know, better dialogue for people to be better connected to one another. And part of us was going out to them and saying, we're going to need your help, but we're not going to film you. Your stories are going to be in this, but we're not going to film you because, like you and Kissinger and Jane Fonda and Daniel Ellsberg, you're still in the public eye, and we don't want our audience to in any way think that you're polishing your own apple or offering a kind of revisionism, as so often happens many, many decades after the fact. What is so nice, as Lynn is suggesting, is that we've now had the opportunity that the film is completely finished to be out in the world sharing it, and often having the great good fortune of having these, you know, distinguished public servants from two different parties and two perhaps ideological extremes offering the same kinds of thoughts and perspectives about the Vietnam.
Exactly.
Not just the failure of leadership that Lynn described, which is so potent to hear both Senator McCain and Secretary Kerry talking about that the other night, but also the possibility of healing. I mean, McCain was so moving that he said, I think this film will begin the healing process that we can understand all those years of captivities, the pain, the injuries, the torture, all of that sort of stuff still informs who he is every day. And he is yearning for the kind of reconciliation that we hope our film can help provide, not because we set out to do that, but because we set out to try to tell a complicated story. Then it was beyond heartening to be on the same stage with two men who know what they're talking about and who see
exactly
the redemptive future possibilities of an American conversation, this time a civil conversation about this most divisive of wars.
I know that you also showed it to some Vietnamese American groups. How did they react to the film?
You know, it's just, maybe it's just the power, as Ken was saying, of people just honestly and directly and authentically telling their stories from all sides. We've had the same reaction among Vietnamese Americans as we had in Vietnam, as we've had here in other parts of the United States. People have come up to us and said, you know, we don't speak about the war. The Vietnamese Americans who are here, who are the sort of second generation or generation and a half, whose parents brought them here, who were born here, know almost nothing about the war. Their parents cannot speak about it. It's too painful. And so they are eager to have the story told as part of our film, to be interwoven into the narrative, and they look forward to watching it together. And we've had the whole film translated into Vietnamese so that everyone who speaks Vietnamese can watch it, both in the United States and in Vietnam. And we've had a number of correspondences. The other day I was talking to someone, and she said that her daughter's boyfriend's parents are Vietnamese and don't speak any English, and he doesn't know anything about the war, and they're going to watch it together, and he's going to find out what happened to his family. So, you know, it's a big, big tent, and there's room for so many possibilities of reconciliation, both within families, within communities, and even across the whole world between America and Vietnam.
from a production and a logistical standpoint, I'm interested in how you sifted through all of this, because compared with your previous films on the Civil War or World War II, where you kind of count on the limits of available archival material and the lack of living witnesses to do some of the editing for you, with Vietnam, you have this embarrassment of riches of news footage, photographs, recordings, interviews to draw on. Was it particularly daunting to whittle all of that down to a manageable story?
Not really. I think we feel that there's similarities between the experience of Civil War and World War II and this one. I mean, you just use the tools we have, and, mm-hmm. and that's our job, is the distillation of however much material there is. And when there is not as much in one area, there may be other ways in which you can do that. But I think that, as we've been talking about in this conversation, it's the complication of the information that made this so challenging. It's the fact that the conventional wisdom that most Americans approach the subject of Vietnam with, that has been so challenged by scholarship and by the direct testimony of individuals, that it becomes important to not just regurgitate and repeat and put into film the same old, that it was possible for us to say to ourselves daily, it's complicated, and look forward to figuring out how to make this more complicated. Not to confuse viewers, it won't, but because life, as every person knows, is very complicated, and our attempts to just fit it into the pigeonhole of black or white, right or wrong, you know, rich or poor, red state, blue state, fails miserably, because sometimes a thing and the opposite of a thing, as Wynton Marsalis told us in Jazz, are true at the same time. And we had to figure out for this project, I think unique among other projects, though we have suspected it in many other films, we had to do it more often and more consistently in this film, is be able to tolerate the fact that, as our own slogan about the film says, there's more than one truth in war.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we go, I have to ask, as someone who made the definitive documentary on the Civil War that explored both sides of that war in a very human way, what do you guys make of the controversy over the removal of Confederate statues going on?
Well, you know, I think it's an age-old thing. The very end of our Civil War film, which was by no means definitive, I think at this stage the Vietnam film represents much more of a definitive thing, because we are aggregating in one place all of the most recent scholarship and unusual access with Vietnam, and it's going to be hard-pressed to find in one-stop shopping the kind of truths and testimony and historical facts aggregated. But at the very end of the Civil War series, the scholar Barbara Field says the Civil War is still going on, it's still being fought, and regrettably, it can still be lost. So we know the ways in which that war is never really over in the United States. With regard to removal of Confederate monuments, I think you do it on a case-by-case basis, but you can do an initial instantaneous culling if you ask when that statue was erected, when that monument was put up, when that flag was sewn into another flag. And if it took place in the late 1880s and early 90s, a time of the emergence of white supremacy in the South, the suppression of African Americans, the growth of the Ku Klux Klan, lynching as a default expression of, quote, justice, unquote, then you take it out. Or if it occurs in the months after the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus Board of Education segregation was illegal, at that point in Mississippi, they put the Confederate flag, and that was not the flag of the Confederate States of America. That was one battle flag of the Army of Northern Virginia, used by the Ku Klux Klan as a symbol of the lost cause. So when you put it in the Mississippi flag in the 1890s, you know exactly what it's about. Take it out. And all the other Southern flags put that Confederate flag into their flags after 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education. Take it out. And most of them, if not all of them, have, except for Mississippi. So when they erect a statue to Robert E. Lee in New Orleans, who never visited New Orleans or Louisiana or New Orleans in 1894, you can go, you know what? Take the damn thing down. But after that, then you're talking about a case-by-case basis. If a town erected in 1866 a statue to their Confederate soldiers, you know, that has got to be contextualized now that we have a much more expansive history, but it isn't easy to say take it all down, or we'll be eventually removing just about everything, because heroism is not perfection. Heroism is, again, a war or a negotiation between people's strengths and weaknesses. And we've just got to be also mindful that we are all complicated people torn on the bias. And so after you remove everything from the 1890s and the 1950s, then you've got a big and more complicated, but I think a very fruitful conversation to be had.
Yeah. The unfortunate thing is that in this day and age, it seems like it's so hard to get anyone to want to analyze the context or the message behind symbols. We just immediately react to the symbol, for better or worse.
Exactly. It's just all reactive. That's what we do, the kind of deep dives that we do, that Lynn and I have spent so long working on this, is trying to say, you know, you can keep saying yes and no, black and white, one and a zero, till you're blue in the face, but life ain't like that. History ain't like that. The Vietnam War ain't like that. And all these contemporary problems aren't going to be solved until we listen to each other, remember that our great genius is compromise, and figure out a way to sustain conversations which always involve listening to the other.
Very well said, Ken. Well, once more, the first episode of this excellent 10-part documentary, The Vietnam War, airs on PBS Sunday, September 17th at 8, 7 Central. Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful.
Today's episode was sponsored by Nadex. Want to try day trading markets but worried about the risk? What if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front? Well, you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. Thanks again to Ken Burns and Lynn Novick for joining me. Episode 1 of The Vietnam War airs Sunday, September 17th at 8, 7 Central on PBS. For more information, visit pbs.org or kenburns.com. And follow Ken and Lynn on Twitter at Ken Burns and at Lynn Novick. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.